There's something to be said for a hobby or vocation that gets us working with our hands. Today's guest figured that out a long time ago when he started building furniture. It's been his life's work, and he not only does the work of making furniture, he thinks about what he and other people get out of the process on a human level. Peter Korn put his thoughts on paper in the book Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Peter Korn has been making furniture since 1974, has written several how-to books on woodworking, and is the founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Rockport, Maine. Peter Korn, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, a pleasure to be here.
The name of the center is certainly intriguing, the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. What goes on there?
Well, we offer courses that range in length from a week to a year. Some of those courses are entry level for amateur woodworkers, and some are professional training in furniture making and design and wood turning. And then we also have an artist in residence program, and we have a gallery. So we have a broad range of programs to advance woodworking as a craft.
You write of people who turn to making things, do things like woodworking, because they feel undernourished. I assume you don't mean in the physical sense.
You're right. Yes.
So undernourished, like how?
Certainly for our students who come in, I meet a lot of people who feel the way I did a long time ago, which is to say they feel like there's some essential thing missing in their life. Some sense of meaning and fulfillment. You can be, we have many students come through who have been very successful in the ordinary ways of the world, in careers, in computer-related careers, or in law, or in medicine, but they have felt it wasn't fulfilling in some deeply intrinsic way, and they're hoping that if they learn to make things well with their own hands and explore their creative abilities, they will find some greater level of satisfaction in what they're doing.
You mentioned some predecessors here, people who have examined this pathway before: Robert Pirsig, Richard Sennett, Matthew Crawford. What sorts of things did they bring to the discussion?
Well, they each brought wonderful things to the discussion. What they have in common is what they say, they're looking at also why we tend in our society to have this sense of unfulfillment. And they're saying that what's really needed is for people to be passionately invested in whatever they're doing, to really care about what they do. And what I'm saying is, upon reflection, caring about what you do is really important to getting satisfaction from your work or from your leisure time activities. But there's more than that. It's when you engage your creative side, when you actually have the experience of coming up with an idea and then doing the hard work to make it real, that is where we find the sort of meaning and fulfillment that so many people seem so hungry for.
Does part of that fulfillment come from just the fulfillment of the task, the completion of something that started really with just the germ of an idea in your own brain and you translated it through your hands?
Oh, absolutely. One of the wonderful things about craft, and I'm writing as a craftsman, is that at the end of the day, you see the result of what you've done indisputably, clearly there, for better or worse. And that measurable result is so intrinsically valuable to people, as opposed to, for example, working all day at a computer screen where you may accomplish a lot, but you never actually see the result in any tangible fashion. And we're very much creatures. We've evolved over millions of years to make things out of natural materials to advance our own survival and success. So it's just biologically, it seems to do a lot for us to work with physical materials and see the results of our efforts.
I have to wonder about the work process itself, though, because, the person you just mentioned sitting in front of a computer, they can go, well, look, it's 5 o'clock, I'm done. When you're building a table or something intricate, some piece of furniture, I mean, you probably don't have that luxury because it's going to take you, I'm assuming, several days. So how do you stop yourself from just working all day, all night until you reach the end of something and just say, okay, I'm at a stopping point, I can put this away for today?
Well, maybe you don't want to do that. I mean, the wonderful thing about being involved in creative work is that it is so fully engaging that you are thinking about it when you're, for example, when I was writing this book, a lot of mornings driving to work after writing for an hour or two, I would have to pull over to the side of the road, take out a notebook, and I just thought of a sort of another way to untangle a complex idea that was confusing me. And I love, personally, love that level of engagement with whatever's going on. I think that's what we should be looking for, not hiding from.
So looking for the opportunities to do things that are going to consume us rather than to look for the opportunities like, yeah, I want a job where I could be done at 4:59:20.
I would say so, yeah. I think if you have a job where you can say, I want to just check out at 5 o'clock and then check in at 9, but not think about it in between, that might be a job that buys you leisure time to do what you want, which is wonderful, but it's not going to be a job that's intrinsically fulfilling. It's not asking much of you or engaging much of you. You're not becoming emotionally invested in it. And we only go around once. Why not do things that we're emotionally invested in?
Peter Korn, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. We'll be back with Peter to talk more about what he's learned and what he's teaching us about the things that we can all gain by engaging in creative pursuits. He's done that for years building furniture. We can talk about some of yours as well. You can give us a phone call or an email on the other side of the break. As we get up to that break, let me remind you once again, day 7 of an 8-day fund drive on Jefferson Public Radio. We are getting so tantalizing. We've just crossed $100,000 on our way to $200,000. So please keep the calls coming in because we're halfway home and we have today and tomorrow to get the other half. So please give us a call, 888-552-6191, or pledge online at ijpr.org. Thanks, and back to the program in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Peter Korn. He started making furniture in 1974 and clearly has not been able to stop himself, nor has he really tried. He's really, really engaged in his work and suggests that the rest of us could be as engaged in making things as well. His latest book is not a how-to book on woodworking like some of his earlier books. It's a why we do things. It literally is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. You can join Peter on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number, our loan phone number today, 541-552-6782. If you get a busy signal, keep on trying. Or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Peter, let's go back in time just a little bit and kind of walk us up to the beginning of furniture building. It sounds like a fairly typical upper-middle-class, post-war upbringing. Do you think you'd grow up like your dad and ride the train to work every day?
I sure did, and it looked like it would be a lot of fun, too. But I had no idea what happened on the other end when he got off the train. I just loved the train station when we used to go pick him up from work in the 1950s.
You and me both, yeah.
Yeah. But yes, I grew up in a professional household, and my parents didn't know anyone who, as far as I know, who actually made a living with their hands. And my father was fairly horrified when I decided to take a job as a carpenter after college. And for many years, he tried to talk me out of it and tell me it wouldn't sufficiently engage my brain. But I really found from the time I first began to become adept at carpentry, and then certainly when I went into furniture making, that the cognitive problem-solving skills involved and then the design challenges are as engaging of the mind as one could hope for.
Now, there's a fun story in your book about first realizing how things are built and put together. Tell us about the mattress on the stairs.
Oh, well, I was a really little guy. I saw that someone at the top, I don't know who, but at the top of the stairway landing, at the top of the stairs, there was a daybed mattress that someone had left there. They must have been moving it. And I thought it would, if I just could push it so it would slide down the stairs, it would be like a magic carpet ride. So I sort of maneuvered it, and all of a sudden it started sliding down the stairs, and then it started picking up speed, and I got a little scared. And wham, it hit the wall opposite the bottom stair, and it broke a hole right through the wall. And then I was amazed, because I had always assumed that that a wall was a solid thing. That I never occurred to me there was a space inside or behind a wall. And there was this broken lathe and this plaster and this mysterious empty space behind the wall. And that has stuck with me, and I can't be profound about it. All I can say is, I started to realize, one, in some vague way, that there was a reality behind appearances, and that things were built. That it stuck with me. I can't actually tell you what it means.
Well, did it lead to an immediate interest in doing carpentry work or building the structures that lead to the walls, or was it something that just
honestly,
sort of stashed for a few years?
It did not. The first time I ever tried making thing was in shop class in about eighth grade, and my father sent me my report card years later. The shop teacher had written, "Peter doesn't really have any aptitude for this. He should do something else." And I didn't remember that. But no, I didn't have any experience working with my hands growing up. It was only because I happened to take a job as a carpenter that I had the good luck to be exposed to working with my hands.
I would have to assume that the period in history in which you went to college, I mean, circa 1970, probably had something to do with your desire to search for meaning, something bigger than what you could find in books and certainly at a desk or traveling the train to the office, as your father did.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1969, and at least among my peers, it seemed like this question, what is a good life and how the heck do you go about living it? Was something we were all grappling with. I'll assume that everyone who's 17 years old grapples with that question still. I'm just not 17 anymore. But that question led a lot of people in my generation to go back to the land and try farming or to go into the crafts or other such activities. And so, yes, I was unconsciously very much part of a generational movement.
And why carpentry then? I mean, you ended up on Nantucket working on basic framing type carpentry. And were you any good at it at first? And who taught you?
Oh, I was horrible at it at first. I mean, really horrible. When I think back to the fact that three young guys spent a whole day to get one rake board on a roof. On the edge of a roof, that was ridiculous.
It's like the old joke about how many college kids does it take to install it? Yeah, never mind.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. But of course, I got better, and I was never a great carpenter because I wasn't fast. But after 2 years of carpentry, I had some friends who were having a baby, and I wanted to make a cradle for them. And I'd seen a picture of a cradle in a book of sculpture. So I bought some pine and dowels, and I went into this unheated old workshop with a rusty table saw. At the end of November, and 3 days later, there was this cradle that had come into existence, and it worked, and it looked beautiful to me, and my friends loved it, and that changed my life. I thought I was going to grow up to design and build houses and sell them, and really what happened was I just became crazy to fixated on rediscovering what seemed like the lost art of furniture making. This was before Fine Woodworking magazine came out, before many of you in California are familiar with Jim Krenov and his work, because he was the founding teacher at the College of the Redwoods in Fort Bragg, which is a wonderful school, and it was before his first book came out. So I really started in isolation.
And you mentioned the solitude during the process, too. That almost sounds like a going off in the wilderness by yourself sort of experience building this cradle.
It was. It was very much so. And also, the other thing is I discovered I'm a person who likes solitude. I was working on a carpentry crew, and that was good, but you're working with other people all the time, and you're working to someone else's standards, not your own. And being in the shop, in control of the work, being able to work to my own idea of excellence on something that mattered to me, that was so affirming. It was I found where I wanted to be.
Did you feel like you caught fire while you were making it, Peter? I mean, did you really just like, ooh, did you get this momentum going?
So we don't talk about things catching fire.
Oh, sorry, it's wood.
Yeah?
Sorry.
All right, do you want to try again?
Did you feel like you really hit a stride, took off, gained only, momentum? Your choice of metaphors here.
Only my curiosity and passion took off. My skills were a long time in coming. I am self-taught, and I was self-employed. I quit my carpentry job about 2 months later and just started making furniture and selling it, even though I did not have a clue what I was doing. But there were very few furniture makers around at that time, and it worked. And And I really only started to learn what the finer parts of the craft about 10 years later, approximately, when I started running a workshop program at the Anderson Ranch Art Center in Colorado. And then I could invite really good furniture makers like Alan Peters or Jim Krenov or Sam Maloof to teach in that program and be in the classroom assisting them. And that's where I started to learn real skills.
Peter Korn's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a furniture maker since 1974. He's written several how-to books on woodworking. This is more of a cerebral kind of book about what we get out of the whole creation process. It's called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number for Jackson and Josephine counties, which is the only one we have available actually at the moment, 541-552-6782. If you get a busy signal, try again. Or send an email to our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You go on quite a riff about the word craft. Do you prefer the noun or the verb, or are you just equally happy with each?
Oh no, the verb to craft, it just upsets me a lot. Not because there's anything wrong with it, but somehow I'm much more comfortable with the noun.
Okay.
So yes, but in any case, I do write. I was really surprised when I looked into the history of the idea of craft to realize that it was a new idea as of around 1870. That before that time period, when it was invented by the British Arts and Crafts movement, people who made things out of wood or glass or metal or clay did not think of themselves as craftspersons, or they did not think of the objects that they made as craft objects. They were tradespeople, and they had a practical trade. And the idea of craft as a separate type of product or a separate way of making things only came into being as a response to the Industrial Revolution. And one reason that was so interesting to me is I looked at the idea of craft that was in my head when I picked up a mallet and chisel in 1974 and realized how dependent I was, or how much I was a product of the particular historical moment that I existed in terms of the way in which I pictured the world and understood it. Because the idea of craft that was going through my head, for example, in 1974, was even very different than the original idea of craft from 1870. And in the book, I traced how that had changed and how much that had to do with broad social forces and the rise of this extreme sense of individualism in the 20th century. So I realize I'm blathering on about this, but I found it really interesting.
Well, it is really interesting, and that's why I asked the question in the first place. We do have a call for you here. It's William in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Korn. His book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Hi, William.
Yeah, hi there. I just wanted to call in. I was a year behind you at GFS, so I didn't really know you. I was only there a year and a half, but I knew your name. My two stepsisters were a couple years ahead of me. But the reason I'm calling is I just want to do a plug for the Siskiyou Woodworking Guild. I assume you don't do last names, or otherwise I'd plug my own business.
Well, tell us the name of the business.
Well, it's William Pepper Fine Furniture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the same thing. I do, you know, a lot of cabinetry and stuff, but my love is making furniture. And I have the same bug that Peter has of making stuff because you have to. You know, there's something about wood that is so engaging and just, you know, and engaging yourself just in the details of the world around you, that like any artist, they don't do it by choice. You know, they don't see artist in the catalog of things to be when you grow up and think, I'm going to do that. It's something that you just have to do.
Uh-huh. All right. Thanks for that, William. Appreciate the perspective. And Peter, is that really is a requirement of you have to do this?
Well, first I want to say how great to hear from someone else who went to Germantown Friends School. It's a really small school, and I'm extremely grateful to that Quaker education for the outlook on life that it left me with, which has so much to do with why I did end up pursuing a career in something like craft, which is really so economically or financially a difficult field. And then I also want to say one other thing, which is this: in this book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, what I've done is I've explored my own experience as a craftsman and as an educator in the field of crafts to try to understand the nature and meaning of creative effort and creative work. But for me, the bottom line in this, having looked at it, is that I'm not advocating that everyone become a craftsperson. But I am advocating that for people who are conscious that they are looking for some sense of meaning and fulfillment in life greater than what they have, where I believe one gets it is by coming up with an idea in one's imagination and then doing the hard work of bringing that idea into the real world. And that can be a craft object. It can be a work of art. It could also be research in a scientific laboratory, and it can be starting a new business. But it's the effort to take a hold of the world, you know, take responsibility for some small change in it by thinking freshly and acting upon that thought, that I think is where we find where we find satisfaction.
So it's not just the commitment of working on somebody else's plan, for example. It's really coming up with the idea yourself, as you did with that first cradle, and carrying it through to completion.
Absolutely. It's what I call, without wanting to be, I don't know what the right word is, profane in any way, inhabiting one's creatorly self. As far as I can see, the highest and best capacity of humankind is this ability we have to bring new things into existence. And it's difficult, challenging work. It's not easy. But it's when you're mired in the midst of that difficulty, when you're in the workshop and you've just had a piece of wood fly off the lathe, and you know, you have to put another, that's not a bad time. It's frustrating at the moment, but you are so personally deeply engaged in what you're doing. There's no question that you're feeling this tremendous sense of fulfillment in what you're doing.
Was there something of a flowering of woodworking at the time that you got into it? You mentioned being out there ahead of some of the woodworking magazines, but it seems like they came along pretty soon after you got started.
Yes, there's a. I am one of tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people who have participated in what is now called the studio craft movement, which was a demographic flow of people into the crafts in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and now is aging out of the population. Just like arts and crafts movement or Art Nouveau or Art Deco or abstract expressionism are all art movements that have had their moment and gone away, and that's fairly true of studio craft. And for anyone who's listening who's involved in the studio crafts, I would just say that my take on studio craft in retrospect is that we tended to confuse virtuosity with virtue, meaning we made objects that were meant to be things that could only come from our own individual minds and hands, and somehow thought that doing that would make us better people. And I'm not saying it doesn't make us better people, but that's sort of the hallmark of what we do. I don't think most young people who are coming to craft today are looking at it in that way.
And how are they looking at it then?
Well, when I go to, first of all, when I used to go to craft shows in the 1970s, everyone who was showing was my age, in their 20s or early 30s, and the audience was relatively young. And if you go to a craft show today, the exhibitors are a much older demographic, and so are the buyers. Hmm. When I go to a show in New York like the International Contemporary Furniture Fair or the Architectural Digest Home Design Show, I see lots of young designers in their 20s and 30s who are doing the same thing in the sense of designing furniture and making that first prototype, and they're as passionate about that as we were, but they're designing and making things that can be built by other people in some quantity and marketed at affordable prices. And so they still have the creative passion, but the context is different.
Well, in a world where IKEA now seems to reign supreme, I mean, is there still a niche for the kind of fine woodwork you do?
Oh yeah, I think that there becomes the more stuff we get that's made cheaply at places like IKEA, I think the more hunger there is for that rare, well-crafted object that was made with someone's personal integrity and concern. If you look at how things are marketed these days, even mass-produced things, the marketers are often stressing the fact that they are handcrafted or individually crafted, which is rarely true, but there's such a value to the consumer in knowing that someone cared about what they made.
Time is just flying by with Peter Korn. His book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. We'll come back and talk more with Peter and take a phone call and your email when we return. But I want to remind you once again, day 7 of 8 of Spring Fund Drive at JPR, close to $102,000. That leaves only $98,000 left to raise. Only $98,000. It's going to be a busy couple of days. We need your help in order to keep these programs on the air. 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or pledge online at ijpr.org. And back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about working with our hands and what it does for our souls. In a sense, Peter Korn is our guest. He's been making furniture since 1974. He's the executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Rockport, Maine. His latest book is not a how-to book. You're not going to learn how to build a table in this book, but you'll learn a lot about yourself and certainly the process that took him to a journey of self-discovery in learning how to make wood furniture. The book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. You can join us on the Exchange. One phone number to give you today, 541-552-6782. That's our Jackson Josephine County number in use for all today because of the fund drive. 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Skeeter in Eugene. Thanks for waiting and welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good morning. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Thanks for the program. I really appreciate your guest reminding us the benefits of really using our hands. And to me, it really brings me into the moment. I'm an artist, and I make mobiles out of driftwood from creeks and shells and beads. And the whole process of, you know, laying things out, having a vision of what you want, and then taking the time to put it together, and then the satisfaction of watching that balanced item spin in circles. It's you know, a passion that is, it's a meditation, really. And it's ironic, as I was waiting to get online with you all, I'm in the midst of cooking a meal, sweeping floors, working together, you know, barn raisings, all of these things. It's really wonderful, and I appreciate your guest, you know, reminding us of how great it is. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter, and thanks for telling us about the work that you're doing. Peter, any thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. The one I'd like to mention is this. In talking to people about this book over the 6 months that it's come out, one thing that I've become really aware of is that we live in a society where people who have creative passions, like Skeeter, are not really provided by the mainstream society with very good yardsticks for valuing what they do. It seems that the only yardsticks we have to value what we do today are money and fame. And if you, for example, look at the pinnacle of the art world and how people in that world write and talk about art, they're measuring it in terms of how much money things sell for and how famous the artist is. And yet, for people who do have a creative passion and are engaged in it, it's clear to us emotionally there is so much more value in what we're doing than you can measure with those two yardsticks, so much more spiritual and emotional and psychological value. And what I've tried to do is examine my own experience closely to start to put a finger on what those other yardsticks or values are that we should be using to measure the value of having a creative passion and working at it.
Did you think of it in deep soul terms from the beginning? I mean, did you know how much your soul felt nourished by woodworking right off the bat, or was it more like, hey, this is fun, and then later on you realize, wow, this is really a deep experience for me?
Oh, it was just, I wasn't thinking reflectively at all when I got started. And what happened, so I started making furniture in 1974, and at first I was just consumed with learning the how of it. And then after a while, I started thinking, I got more and more interested in design, and so I was more passionate about that. And then I started thinking about the why of it. And I had this experience in 1990 that was, for me, the seed of this book and quite a transformational experience. I was writing an artist statement in a workshop that was being conducted by an art critic. And I should explain that the first 6 years I was a furniture maker, I sold my work in craft shows. And then in 1980, I started showing in fine arts galleries. And so I had to write artist statements. And what I was writing in my artist statement in 1980 was I was trying to make furniture that had the qualities of simplicity and integrity and grace. 10 years later, in 1990, I was writing this new artist statement, and I realized the reason I had become a furniture maker in the first place was that I had imagined, subconsciously, that if I got good at this, I would be cultivating more of the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace in myself. And so I realized that for me, the reason that I go into the workshop all along has been that somehow I think that I'm going to emerge from the other end of this creative gauntlet as a different, better, or more understanding person. I'm going to know something that I didn't know when I started. And I honestly think that is the primary motivation for everyone in every creative art who goes into the studio to create something.
Is it still as tough a gauntlet as it was before? I mean, we have this image of people trying to beat you up with clubs and stuff as you run between them. But over time, with your level of expertise, it seems like it would have gotten a little easier. Or is it really just about the journey of creation?
No, it's easier because I know that, for example, the empty feeling that I will sometimes have when a project is done, I now know that will pass. And so experience has taught me some things, but really, and I should say, I guess I should also say that being further along in life and having some solid work behind me, I have more confidence that everything will work out, is the best way to put it.
Couple of questions just on the physical part of the woodworking craft, which is, number one, how long you felt like it took to get reasonably good at it, where you felt like you could take on any task. And I guess by way of example, the devilishly hard dovetail joint from which I still have a scar in the middle of my hand from trying to make one as an 11-year-old.
Yes. Well, so being self-taught, I had a really long, slow learning process. And I will say that anyone, for example, I'm envious of the students who come to our school and take our 9-month-long furniture training course, because really when they finish, they know more about a lot of things than I even know today. I wish I'd had the sense to get formal training, and I wish there had been an appropriate place in 1974 to do that. Well, I don't know where I'm going from that, honestly.
How long it took you to get good at it, and by God, how long it took you to get a dovetail joint right?
Well, I'm still not the best at it, I'll say, but it did take me several years to get a good dovetail joint at the rate I was going. Now, honestly, though, I see absolute beginners come into a 2-week basic woodworking class I teach here every year, and at the end of those 2 weeks, they're cutting dovetails as good as anything I would cut. So it just depends on how you get started and how open you are to other people's information.
So, Peter Korn, is your house filled with your own furniture and nothing but, or is there a mixture of sources in there?
Well, my house has plenty of my own furniture that I failed to sell in it, yes.
But what's that like, though? I mean, I'm sure it's not like this, you know, standing there looking at you like an item of shame because it didn't sell. But, I mean, you live in a space with so much of you in it. I mean, it's not like you just bought stuff from IKEA was the example we gave before. But, I mean, this stuff really says something about you and your own home. What's it like to live in that?
If you came in my house, you would think it was remarkably spare with not very much in it. But it is true that everything in it, whether I made it or someone else made it, is an object that has meaning to me, maybe because of who made it or because one of my parents gave it to me. So it is not, you know, I'm firmly convinced that for all of us, objects, physical objects, carry spiritual weight, and their importance to us is often that somehow they affirm our own stories of who we are and how the world works. And I think that's one of the great things about being selective about what you live with and having the privilege of doing so, is you can surround yourself with things that are meaningful and therefore, I don't know exactly how to say it, but provide more of a sense of belonging and comfort in your life.
Do you have religion, or has this become your religion in a sense?
Well, this has become my spiritual, my spiritual understanding would be the way to, my understanding of the human spirit. I think that I now understand the idea of meaning. When I talk about one's life having meaning, meaning is where one thinks. Well, like when you have a sense of meaning, it's because you think that your words, thoughts, or actions have some impact in a larger moral sphere. That's what gives us a sense of meaning. And when a creative person goes to make something that's never existed before, they are inevitably exploring, from my point of view, again, ideas of who they are, who they might become, which is to say, what is it to be human? Exploring it in some small way, not necessarily in some deeply conscious way. But when you're asking, who can I become, you're really participating in the largest moral sphere of all, which is the ongoing conversation that humanity has over the centuries and over the millennia about what it is to be human and what we can be, what is our potential. And that's the context in which creative work truly has meaning for the people who are doing it.
The people who read this book will learn a lot, not so much about making dovetail joints, but about the things they will learn on the way to making that dovetail joint. Peter Korn's been our guest. His book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
You bet. Take care.